Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Before we get to the debt ceiling countdown, later this hour we'll be talking about traveling with kids, specifically flying cross-country with babies. So we're inviting you to post your travel tips to the show page at WNYC.org. How many of you are facing this summer? Are your heads nodding out there? Oh, my God, I've never done this before. I'm flying to L.A. with my 18-month-old, and I don't know how I'm going to get through it. So there are other people out there who've been through it who can help you. And we're appealing to you a summer travel tips for little kids, focusing on that experience as the centerpiece of it, let's say flying across country with a baby, but generally surviving long trips with very little kids. Post to Facebook, the Brian Lehrer Show Facebook page, or use this Twitter hashtag in advance of the segment, Kid Travel Tips. Use that hashtag to tweet us, Kid Travel Tips, and in about a half hour, or a little more than that, toward the end of the hour. We'll take your phone calls on this as well. And parents planning such trips, maybe you will survive as a result of hearing our segment. All right, right now, debt ceiling countdown. 3 weeks from today, the federal government has committed to spend more than it will take in by August 2nd. So if they can't figure out a way to raise the debt ceiling and borrow money to cover it, they will start defaulting for the first time ever on U.S. government obligations. President Obama in an interview with CBS News anchor Scott Pelley last night.
This is not just a matter of Social Security checks. These are veterans checks. These are folks on disability and their checks. There are about 70 million checks that go out.
Can you guarantee as president those checks will go out on August the 3rd?
I cannot guarantee that those checks go out on August 3rd if we haven't resolved this issue, because there may simply not be the money in the coffers to do it.
President Obama yesterday on CBS making the point to the American people and to congressional Republicans who want a lot for raising the short-term borrowing limit, more than the president is willing to give at this point, trillions of dollars in long-term spending cuts and no new revenue, no new taxes or tax code changes to pay for them. We continue to count down to the debt ceiling deadline with various guests. Today, New York Congresswoman Nan Hayworth, the freshman Republican from Mount Kisco in Westchester, up to near Poughkeepsie. Hi, Congresswoman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be with you.
First, do you agree with the president on what the consequences of failing to raise the debt ceiling would be to seniors and veterans and other Americans?
Brian, the president's language is troubling because he is essentially trying to strike fear into the hearts of Americans who should be reassured that all of us who care about the soundness of our approach to debt and deficit would certainly honor the obligations that we have to our seniors, to our veterans, and of course, to paying our sovereign debt. This is a very serious issue that we face. We have to do so responsibly and productively. And we have reached this point. We have reached this impasse because Congresses and administrations past, both Democrats and Republicans, have, but especially in the past 2 years under this president, have not anticipated that we would have the sort of debt situation that we currently face.
So to clarify where you are on this, were you saying that even if we don't raise the debt ceiling, that Americans shouldn't be afraid that they're not going to get their Social Security checks, their veterans benefits, anybody who's invested in U.S. Treasury bonds doesn't have anything to worry about, whether or not we raise the debt ceiling by August 2nd? Was that your position?
First point, Brian, is that I anticipate that we will, in fact, come to an agreement. President Obama himself has said, and he said so at the very least in December of 2010, that we cannot afford to raise taxes in this environment. Republicans certainly I can't presume to speak for my entire conference, but there is broad acceptance, I believe, that we do need to raise the debt ceiling responsibly. And responsibly means that we have to have at least dollar for dollar spending cuts for every dollar by which we raise the debt ceiling, and that we cannot include new taxes. Those are counterproductive. Revenues will grow organically when we allow productive Americans to re-enter the workforce. We have 14 million Americans who are eager to enter the workforce. We need to put working capital back in the marketplace. So I think there is going to be an agreement. I think the president understands the urgency of this. I think he is endeavoring politically to do all he can to push his point of view, which is that he does want to raise taxes. He's made that clear, even though he said it will not benefit our economy. He still wants to do it. But I think he'll come around. And I do believe that we will responsibly approach the issue of reassuring those who hold United States Treasury bonds that we do not intend to default on that debt, default on the debt.
His position is that some of the tax loophole closings and other things would not hurt the economy and would ultimately be beneficial, but you'll disagree on that. But let me play you two other clips that kind of echo the debate within the Republican caucus, in this case in the Senate. Here is Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who seemed to agree with the president that failure to raise the debt ceiling is pretty unthinkable.
If we're unable to come together, we think it's extremely important that the country reassure the markets that default is not an option.
And we also had Republican Senator Jim DeMint on this show last week, a Tea Party favorite, who actually is denying that it's as dire a deadline as the majority thinks. Here's Jim DeMint.
We're not going to default, first of all. I mean, Secretary Geithner, I believe, has been irresponsible in suggesting we would, because if we never raise the debt ceiling, we're going to have enough revenue to pay our debts, to pay Social Security, to pay our troops. But what we talk about is disruptive, and it would be. We've made a lot of commitments to contractors, to government employees, and if we start delaying those payments, it is disruptive. But we don't have a good decision here, because if we just raise the debt limit again without serious permanent structural reform, I think the disruption economically into the value of our dollar could actually be worse.
So how much do you agree with Jim DeMint, Congresswoman?
Senator DeMint is absolutely correct that we have to have a sound long-term plan to reduce our debt burden. And in fact, as you know, our bond rating agencies have indicated the same. They have said that there is a negative forecast if we don't act to control our debt burden now. And so that it's incumbent upon all of us in the House, in the Senate, and on the president to take a responsible approach. The president wants to raise revenues. The way to do that is by activating our economy and putting 14 million Americans back to work. Government spending doesn't do that. Tax relief does do that.
But do you agree with DeMint when he says, I believe Secretary Geithner has been irresponsible in suggesting that we would default if we never raise the debt ceiling? We're going to have enough revenue to pay our debts, said Senator DeMint. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann has been very much on that point. It's a minority position, but I'm just trying to clarify how close you are to that.
Brian, fundamentally, we're not seeking to reach that point of differential decision making by Secretary Geithner. I agree with Senator DeMint that Secretary Geithner and the president should not make such threats. There's no question. But I also agree that we would need to prioritize, and I can't imagine that we would not prioritize the obligations that are critical to pay our sovereign debt obligations, to pay our soldiers and veterans, and to pay our obligations to our seniors.
And what about the local impact on New York City and vicinity? Here's Mayor Bloomberg speaking yesterday.
If America, for the first time in its history, defaults on its obligations, it would have a catastrophic effect on our financial system and on our credibility around the world.
One more time, Congresswoman.
I agree with Mayor Bloomberg. We absolutely have to be responsible. The rest of the world is looking to us. There is no question. And the rest of the world is looking to us not only regarding our short-term actions, but also, crucially, about our long-term approach to this problem. We need to have an economy that is vibrant and more productive than any other economy on the face of the planet, really, because, let's face it, we are the defense of the free world. So we need to make sure that we are acting responsibly to cut federal spending where the federal government does not have a crucial, unique role. We need to have that strong approach. We must not raise net tax burdens. We need to relieve tax burdens. A flatter, fairer tax code makes a lot of sense so that we can activate investment in the vibrant economy that 14 million Americans need so that they, too, can contribute to the work of our federal government that is crucial.
All right. On the revenue question, which you were raising before, House Speaker John Boehner almost made a deal, as you know, with the president over the weekend for $4 trillion in debt reduction over the next decade, with three-quarters of that coming from spending cuts and one-quarter coming from what the president calls closing tax loopholes on everything from special depreciation rates for oil companies that buy equipment, the famous corporate jet tax deduction, taxing hedge fund managers' pay as income or as at the lower capital gains rate rather than a salary, things like that. Should Boehner have accepted that deal, in your opinion? Obviously not.
Brian, not having seen the details, but hearing this this version of it, if you will, again, we can't afford to place net burdens on our enterprise economy. So when we approach the tax code, there really has to be an omnibus phenomenon in much the same way that President Reagan approached it in the early 80s. There was indeed a closing of loopholes, but there was also a reduction of the baseline rates. Right now, our baseline corporate tax rate is the highest in the world, and that is a significant problem. So, of course, resourcefully, a lot of loopholes and exemptions have been created that unfortunately advantage some industries and some sectors differentially versus others. So we need to definitely approach that entire issue and throw all of the credits, so-called loopholes, exemptions, et cetera, into the mix and broaden the base, flatten the rates for everyone.
But you're saying no fixing the loopholes, closing the loopholes, and, you know, eliminating things that even you think may be absurd and unfair and special interest giveaways unless we lower all the rates. Why do they have to be tied?
Because otherwise we are increasing the net burden on our enterprise economy. And right now, I couldn't agree more. We have a skewed way of approaching those revenues. There's no question about it. But we don't want to have a jolt that takes working capital out of the economy that desperately needs it. President Obama, again, himself said it in December of 2010, and he was right. So we do need to make the tax code far simpler, fairer, flatter. And I think there is a growing sentiment that ultimately has to be part of our long-term approach.
Congresswoman Nan Hayworth, Republican freshman from Westchester and points north up to around Poughkeepsie, as we talk about the debt ceiling debate. And here's a call from Westchester from Harvey. You're on WNYC. Hello, Harvey.
Yes, good morning. Congresswoman, are you aware of the fact that we fought two wars off budget, and I mean off budget? It was all treated as extraordinary expenses. Not one dime was paid of that. No taxes were paid to cover those wars. If we are going to fight wars, shouldn't we pay for them?
Harvey, we do end up, as you know, we do end up paying for them. And in fact, in the House of Representatives, we have been endeavoring to try to block expenditures on the intervention in Libya that President Obama has engaged us in. So I couldn't agree more. This is not the time for us to be expanding our military obligations. We should be prudently reducing them.
But by that standard, and I realize you weren't in Congress at the time, Harvey is really saying the Bush administration and the Republican Congress of that era approved these two huge Afghanistan and Iraq off-budget wars because they were placed off-budget. They were borrowed for instead of paid for by paying for them. Is that something that you're critical of in retrospect, even though you weren't there?
Brian, clearly, we have to approach everything that this federal government undertakes from this moment onward, given that this is what I'm responsible for as a member of Congress, with the utmost scrutiny. I cannot, unfortunately, I can't take responsibility for the decisions that were made by Republicans nor by Democrats, both of whom, both parties, members of both parties, have done things or undertaken obligations that were unwise either at that time or in retrospect. But I would certainly contend that the Libyan engagement is one that we have to look at now, that we are engaged in now as a Congress in determining how we spend on that. And this is – it's not productive for us to try to retrograde. Clearly, I would not – knowing what I know about Iraq, I would not have voted to support that intervention. But that is not relevant to our current situation, except insofar as we view these military expenditures mm-hmm. in the current budget.
I want to take one more call for you. We're getting a lot of callers with – a version of this question. We'll take Eric in Brooklyn to ask his version of it. Eric, you're on WNYC.
Good morning. Congresswoman, I'd like to ask you, what is the proof that tax cuts create jobs? Because since the Bush tax cuts in 2003, if I'm not mistaken, we have experienced the lowest GDP growth since the end of World War II. And since Obama extended the Bush tax cuts, Why haven't there been jobs created? Why have we been losing jobs?
And the other half of that, Congresswoman, that people are asking is, do you really believe what you said, that cutting tax rates produces more revenue for the federal government? President Reagan's former budget director, David Stockman, after the Reagan administration came out and said, no, that was never really true, except in very minor specific categories. Cutting taxes is a means to starving the beast, you know, as conservatives put it, to keeping money out of the federal government because they don't believe in federal programs.
Brian, there are a number of academic pieces of evidence we can point to. Certainly after the Reagan tax reforms in 81, 82, in which they did close various loopholes, but they did quite substantially lower baseline rates, including reducing the top marginal tax rate from something like 70% to 28%. The Cato Institute has said there was growth in at least eight out of 10 parameters of economic assessment. So that was a highly successful approach. When we look at the federal government's effect on the economy in general, clearly we have to factor in what the federal government spends. So clearly we have tax policy and we have federal spending. I would certainly contend that during the administration of President George W. Bush, far more spending went on than we could sustain. More spending was undertaken for the long term than we can sustain. And so there is certainly that when we factor in how the federal government affects the economy. It's known, Christina Romer and her husband did studies to show, she, of course, no longer with the administration, to show, as I recall, that the multiplier effect of a dollar spent in the private economy is greater than that of a dollar spent by the federal government. And certainly those of us who have experienced the work of bureaucracies can recognize this intuitively. So, you know, you don't make the economy productive by cycling dollars through a bureaucracy. And if you want a perfect example of that in a very local way, look at how New York State's high tax system, which Governor Cuomo has now endeavored wisely to try to reverse, has resulted in a net out-migration of residents from the state of New York. We're losing two congressional seats in New York the state of Texas, with a vibrant economy, a much more rational tax structure, a less burdensome tax structure, has gained four congressional seats. And the out-migration has occurred across socioeconomic lines. One final piece, if you look at the work of Alberto Alicina, who's in the Department of Economics at Harvard University, he and Silvia Ardaño did a study that showed that, in fact, when nations face fiscal crisis, two interventions succeed in relieving that crisis. One is to cut spending, the other is to cut taxes. Do one or the other or both. So this is what we have to heed when we look at how we activate the economy. Right. Motivated workers in a vibrant free enterprise economy become the engine of growth, and that is the way this country has elevated generation upon generation of immigrants, including my own mother, from reduced circumstances to prosperity.
All right. Well, liberal economists will disagree, but you cited specific studies there, so we'll have to get their academics and your academics and have a good smackdown on this one of these days. You know, we talked yesterday on the show about ordinary tax deductions like charity and home mortgage interest and routine business expenses. One idea being discussed in at least some think tanks is to not let the highest earners with the highest tax rates deduct everything at those rates. So if you make a low income and get taxed at 15%, your home mortgage interest deduction is only 15% of that interest. If you make a $500,000 and you get taxed at 35%, you get 35% of your home mortgage interest from the rest of the taxpayers, even though you can more afford it. So does it make sense to subsidize wealthier people more than poorer ones for home buying and other things?
Brian, the closer we bring our tax structure to being flat, the better off all of us will be.
That would be a flattening of deductions.
That would be, a flattening of deductions. What happens? What happens when you have that kind of an arrangement? And it's not to say there can be an element of progressivity. But when you have a flatter structure, when you have more of us participating in the federal revenue collection, if you will. And again, you can have an element of progressivity. There's no question. But what happens? Well, then those who may earn more will save and invest more. And that's what we want. That's why when President Reagan reduced marginal tax rates, there was an activation of the economy. That's where opportunity comes from. That's where growth comes from.
But is this unflat deduction system particularly perverse? Because if you have a progressive taxation system, then richer people get taxed at a higher rate, presumably still left with, you know, a lot more income to live on than people who make less money. This is specifically a regressive unflat system the way we have, where richer people actually get more subsidies from the rest of the taxpayers for things like home mortgage interest. And the president apparently wants to raise a lot of money to close the revenue by just flattening the deduction system without flattening the tax rates themselves. Could you go we have about a minute left, but could you go for that?
I want to see no net tax increases, Brian. We can't afford it. So I'm all for reexamining deductions, exemptions, and credits, and that has to be accompanied by a compensatory reduction in tax rates. Federal government never manages to collect more than 19% of gross domestic product in taxes anyway. People will do things to avoid tax burdens. Let's get them investing in the active economy. It's really not hard to imagine that we could put more Americans to work if we can assure the folks who want to have the opportunity to invest that they're going to be able to put their dollars into the active economy instead of channeling it to the federal government.
We leave it there with Congresswoman Nan Haworth, freshman Republican from about the Mount Kisco area in Westchester up to around Poughkeepsie. Thank you so much, as always, for coming on our show.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, Gary Young, a Brit from West Indian descent living in Brooklyn, explores his identity and yours. He's written a book with a fresh take on identity called Who Are We and Should It Matter in the 21st Century? And then we'll take those tips from all of you who have ever flown across the country with a baby. How can somebody survive it if they're taking such a trip this summer? And you can tweet your suggestions to the hashtag travel with kid travel tips. Kid travel tips. That's the hashtag. Kid travel tips. Stay with us.